It's time for security now. Steve Gibson is here. He's been reading all the releases from DEF CON and Black Hat, all the new security exploits. We'll cover those and a whole lot more. This is going to be a jam-packed, great episode. You stick around. Security Now is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 572, recorded Tuesday, August 9th, 2016. DEF CON and Black Hat, Part 1. Security Now is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/securitynow. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your house. Go to ring.com/securitynow and get $50 off one of their Ring of Security kits, the bundle kit or the pro bundle kit with this limited time offer. And by Drobo, a family of safe and expandable yet easy to use storage arrays. Drobos are designed to protect your important data forever. Visit drobostore.com to learn more and use the code TWIT100 to save $100 off select Drobos. It's time for Security Now, the show where we talk about your privacy and security online with this fellow right here. His name happens to be the illustrious Steve Gibson. Hi, Steve.
Leo, this is...
Peace in our times.
The penultimate episode...
Yes.
...of year 11.
You used the word correctly in a sentence. You have grasped the meaning.
I forced myself to, because as I have clearly put on the record, it's a useless word that, like,
you know
no
what
one
else?
Has any need for.
This is also the penultimate show in this old studio. Next week will be our last show in the Brick House, and the week following will be in the East Side Studios.
And from what you've said, our listeners are not going to notice any big difference. Like, looking at you there, where it's like, oh.
It should look the same. My desk will be cleaner. But we're everything you see here, and most people, by the way, it's a tiny percentage that actually watch the show. But most people who watch the show, everything you see here, you will see in the new, it'll look the same. There may be some subtle differences, but it will look the same. Actually, one of the differences is... I'm in a fishbowl. We used to have curtains all the way around it so that nobody could see, but they took the curtains down, and now I'm in a fishbowl. But
and we commented about how much brighter the sound was.
Yeah, it looks
was.
Different, yeah. The new studio will be – it sounds different, yeah. But the new studio will be drywall around three walls of it, so – but there will be windows to the outside world in my new studio, so that's cool, unlike this studio. So – anyway, nice. It's just different, and but we're going to take all these pieces with us, which is, I think, okay, because I don't think the people who are building a brewery in here want them.
Oh, so you're going to actually move your yes. office installation into the other building.
Exactly. Nice. All the stuff that's here, going.
Nice.
Yeah.
Except apparently some of the books you're leaving behind.
Well, I don't have room for as many bookshelves, so I have to go through them. But, you know, programming books from the year 2008 aren't that useful.
You know, and, you know.
You have worse.
You
have a worse
situation.
In
DOS internals books. And, and actually, I did need them when I did SpinRite 6 because I was doing new things with the VGA adapter that I had not done before. And you can't find anything on programming the VGA adapter any longer. So I don't even, I mean, even online, it was scarce. So I was glad that I have sort of an archaeological environment here. So for me, yeah, it's a little bit different.
And you're never moving. How long have you lived in that apartment?
Since, well, this condo since 1984.
Okay. So yeah. Yeah, and there's no reason to think that you will be at any time required to pack those books up again.
No. That'll be somebody else's problem, as we say.
So if I were in that situation, I would not ever get rid of a book. I love books. I hate to get rid of books.
I do, too. Yeah. Although, Leo, they're just not practical anymore.
Not at all.
I mean, like, when was the last time I actually went to a book rather than just typing a phrase into Google, and there's, like, everything I could possibly want to know and much more current and even some commentary. I mean, it's all changed.
I can only imagine, though, the look on the guy's face who wanders over to our used bookstore and finds the best collection of old Python books ever.
Well, for the right person.
Web 2.0. Oh, for the right person, it's a treasure trove. And these were expensive books. There's probably $10,000 worth of books behind me.
Remember how expensive technical resources used
really
to be?
They really were expensive. Now
I'm seeing that actually a lot in medical stuff that I'm having to buy sometimes. Right, I have some $300 textbooks that I've purchased. And it's like, do I really need this? It's like, yeah, well, apparently I do. So,
or how do they get away with this? You know?
Yeah. So we are post-DEF CON and Black Hat with a overflowing cornucopia of new horrors to share. And so many, in fact, that I called this part one. Even as I was sort of putting this one to bed, I looked up in my Twitter feed and I found a whole bunch of other things that is like, oh, no, okay. We're not done yet. So all kinds of fun things. I do not want this to be the pound on Microsoft for Windows 10 podcast. That's not what this is going to become. I've said my piece about Windows 10. I've implemented my piece with Never 10. By the way, it just crossed 1.8 million downloads. Naturally, it's slacked off a lot since they stopped pushing Windows 10 on everybody. But still, 5,000 people a day, for some reason,
Why are they downloading it now?
I have no idea. Although we still get downloads of the Click of Death podcast and things. So it's like, I think for some people, they're like, you know, they're like you and I with books. They're like, oh, I might need this someday. So, we do have a distressing quantity of distressing Windows 10 news. I heard you mention on MacBreak Weekly, and we'll cover it here, Apple's changing bug bounty policy, which is nice. Some newly disclosed Android takeover flaws. Some that have been patched, some won't get around to being patched until next month because they happened more recently. Yet another clever and sad and distressing way to track web visitors around the internet. At DEF CON, some hackers spoofed Tesla's automobile sensors, which I kind of think is a non-story, but I want to explain why.
We have
Firefox news, some LastPass news, some miscellany. Then three more things I stuck afterwards. A 19-year-old stubborn decision by Microsoft, which has come home to roost. And then two different groups have found new problems with HTTP and HTTP2. So, most of this courtesy, but not all, courtesy of DEF CON and Black Hat. And as I said, I was looking up at my feed, and there's like even some more interesting looking things. So, and one of these, in the case of this 19-year-old stubborn decision by Microsoft, this one's I'm going to have to take a look at. I think we're going to have some horrified listeners.
Uh-oh.
Not that we don't usually.
Uh-oh.
But extra horrified. So, a great podcast.
Well, as always.
Penultimate year 11.
But when you say penultimate year 11, you means we'll be beginning year 12 of the show
in two weeks.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. Wouldn't it be easy to keep track of now how long we've been in the new studio? Because it's coincident with the move to the new studio. That's good. We begin our 12th year in our third studio. Wow.
And each one's lasting much longer than the one before.
This one should last me, like you, for the rest of my life. I am not moving ever again. We signed a 10-year lease with a 5-year option.
Nice.
So that, let's see, that'll take me to 74, and maybe I'll retire in 15
years. You and I will be like Jerry Pornell by that point.
And then, but you know what? Jerry still has a lot of things, good things to say. So
Windows 10 is still
polished, flying. That will be fun. Ladies and gentlemen, our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. They know that anybody who listens to this show is pretty much, you know, into the technology thing and very likely does not want to apply for a home loan or a refi the old-fashioned way, you know, bringing stacks of papers and books and banker boxes to your mortgage broker, sending faxes back and forth, physically signing with your pen. Use blue ink, not black. That's Bob Cratchit stuff. We are in the 21st century. It's about time we started to borrow money the same way. When you're ready to buy a new home or refi your existing home, I want you to visit Rocket Mortgage. Now, you're going to feel good about this. It comes from Quicken Loans. This is the best loan company. They offer the most programs. They have lots of ways for you to borrow. They're super smart, great customer service. And now with Rocket Mortgage, you can do it all online. You don't have to go through stacks of old files and paperwork. You know, it's dangerous going in that basement. You don't know what's down there. You don't want to go in the attic. No. Share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. You don't even have to get up from the couch because you can do it all on your iPad, your iPhone, your Android device. It's a quick online process you can manage from the convenience of your couch. I love this. If you're looking to refinance, if you're looking to buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today. It's quickenloans.com/security now. quickenloans.com/security now. Of course, an equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030. Rocket Mortgage. They come to you from Quicken Loans, and they come to you from the future. quickenloans.com/security now. We thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of the Security Now show with Mr. Stevie G.
So, Woody Leonard, who writes the Woody on Windows column.
Talk about old timers. He's been doing that forever.
Yep. His title of his most recent posting was Windows 10 Anniversary Update Woes Continue. And I just thought I'd run through these quickly for listeners who at least will have a feeling if they've had some of these problems to know that they're not alone. His little posting starts out before I paraphrase. He said, problems with last week's anniversary update keep piling up and solutions remain elusive. And then he says, late last week, I recommended that you actively block the Windows 10 anniversary update. The past few days have brought yet another wave of complaints. Here's a sample, he writes. Apparently, Windows 10 is freezing on a number of systems. And I actually think that later on I'll get to at least some of the causes of these things, because in digging into other stories, I realized, ooh, this is what's causing that problem and so forth. So there was on Reddit, Woody was following some dialogue that had 680 comments about post-anniversary update freezing of all the systems. And apparently some of this involves some incompatible AV software that Microsoft, as it's explained, actually by McAfee, not himself, McAfee, you know, now owned by Intel, the corporation, that Microsoft did not have time to incorporate the checks for compatibility of specific McAfee AV versions, and so it'll update over and be incompatible and thus cause a lot of problems. In any event, Woody notes that nobody yet has found a complete solution for these. And he notes from his own experience that Edge, the new browser, which is in many ways a good thing. We've talked about how Microsoft bit the bullet and just said, okay, we can't not keep pushing IE's code base forward any longer. We just need to start again. And when you do that, you have the advantage of all the experience that you've gained. And in sort of, you know, instead of cobbling things together, or in many cases, not being able to do what you would like to do from an old code base, you can make it the way you want it. And we know that Edge has a very good, strong security model, and is very fast and has a state-of-the-art scripting interpreting system. So in many ways, it's good. However, Woody notes that Edge still has plenty of problems. He says, I've hit situations where Edge will not close by clicking on the red X. Also, I can X out of the last open tab and Edge keeps running. When closing, only the only open tab should shut down the program as a whole. The problems seem to appear after visiting sites with lots of ads, like the ones, he says, linked to from MSN.com, for example. Once the problems start, they don't go away. The only solution, he writes, that he's found is to reboot. And then two different antivirus companies have reported problems. As I mentioned before, McAfee warns, actually with emphasis in their note, do not upgrade to the Windows 10 anniversary update without first verifying whether your McAfee product is compatible. This caution affects the products listed in the section above of their notice. Then they said Microsoft intended to implement an upgrade and installation check to ensure that no incompatible McAfee product versions could be installed or were present. Due to time constraints, Microsoft could not implement the intended version check in the Windows 10 anniversary update. So, unfortunately, that leaves people with this, you know, update to the big anniversary update. And, I mean, and this apparently causes real problems because, as we know, we've been talking about this recently, one of the things that the AV tools have started doing is digging themselves very deep down into the kernel. This has been causing problems, as we know, because it can increase the attack surface of the machine. If you have a third party's code inspecting everything that comes through the network, well, it has to be flawlessly implemented, which is something that Microsoft has carefully been doing over a long period of time. If there are things like buffer overruns in that add-on code, that creates vulnerabilities, and we've covered those in the not too distant past on the podcast. So, but as a consequence, it means that if there's some changes that Microsoft made in the kernel where they normally would have the right to make such changes, you know, the idea being that it's the API layer, this application programming interface, that's supposed to be the boundary, the formal boundary between applications and the OS. And the idea being that as long as the API stays the same, the OS vendor is free to do anything it wants to behind the API because it's that layer, that way that the applications have of talking to the operating system, that needs to remain uniform. But then who cares how the job gets done? Well, what's happened is by essentially putting kernel drivers in the OS, and in many cases, Microsoft doesn't sort of officially support the kind of things that these vendors want to do. So then they have to even break the kernel API. There is another API, for example, for device drivers, which is completely different from the application programming interface. And that API, as any, assumes certain things that driver developers would want to do and makes those OS services available. Well, the problem is if these vendors need to do something outside the API, they will have to hook functions in the kernel, which then makes the whole system far less stable. So, you know, reading between the lines, you know, our advice for a while has been, unless you really have to have these things down added to the operating system, unless there's some overriding reason, it's really becoming better not to use these. And as we've also talked about, many of these are now also putting certificates in your system and then not managing them as responsibly as we would like, which then allows for third parties to come along and create spoofed website attacks. And then finally, he says, I'm still unclear, that is what Woody says, I'm still unclear about the ability to block what he calls crapware tiles. He says, I wrote about the problem a couple of weeks ago. I do know what causes this now, and we'll get to that in a second. Admins cannot keep Microsoft from pushing crapware live tiles onto Win 10 Pro PCs because certain group policies don't work in the anniversary update. And believe it or not, and I'm stunned by this news. Microsoft has removed a bunch of very useful mitigations against many of the things that people found objectionable about Windows 10. They took them out of the anniversary update for the pro version, not the educational version and not the enterprise version. I think enterprise, they left them in because the enterprise wants control. Education, they left them in because they didn't want to force educational usage to have that if they didn't want it. And that left this, like all of the rest of us, non-enterprise and non-educational, that is the Windows 10 professional people, without the same level of control over this that the other, you know, the very high end and the very low end both have, which if I were using Windows 10 would annoy me a lot. And he writes, my current Win 10 Pro AU, as in anniversary update machine, has tiles for Solitaire, Candy Crush, Soda Saga, this is just so sad, Pandora, Asphalt 8, Age of Empires, Castle Siege, Farmville 2, Minecraft, Twitter, and Get Office. In other words, about half of my start menu tiles are unabashed Microsoft installed crapware, all on a machine that's been through the official start fresh regimen. He doesn't want those, and he can no longer turn them off.
Not true. You just right click them and you remove them. They're stubs for installing. They are not the app. That's not true.
Okay. Well, I have the registry.
I don't have them. Here, you want to edit? You don't have to edit. Please don't edit the registry. You right click them and delete them. Oh my God! You want to see my startup after Windows 10 anniversary? None of that. None of that stuff. Because I removed it. You just right click and you say remove. And they're not the apps, by the way. They are ads. I admit they're stubs that you click them and it'll take you to the store and you download it. Also, I should point out that you're not allowed to, if you took the free upgrade, deny updates. That was the part of the deal. You've agreed to all updates. You can delay them, but ultimately you'll have to take the anniversary update. You can't not do it.
So others are reporting that anniversary update is not respecting unknown partition types. They're finding that installing the anniversary update, for example, in dual boot environments where they have Linux and Windows, that they lose access to Linux. And so, you know, it's common practice to install Windows first and Linux afterwards, because Microsoft does have a habit of overriding the boot sector, which would cause you to lose your multi-boot behavior. But this has gone further, and there's a lot of report of this on the net that Microsoft is just blowing away non-Windows partitions as part of the anniversary update. The term I'm seeing is borking dual boot partitions. So be advised that that, you know, that could happen. You might want to make an image of the whole drive before you move, if you haven't already. Okay, so the reason that what Woody said made sense to me was that there is extensive and pretty clear coverage of the group policies and registry entries which Microsoft is documenting they have changed. And they're saying when you go to group policy edit and look at these keys, they're specifically saying that these are no longer available for Windows 10 Pro. One being turning off the Microsoft consumer experience, which controls, among other things, the installation of third-party apps and extra links on Windows 10. Now, so maybe, Leo, what you're saying is that Windows will, or Microsoft will push these, and then the user is free to delete them.
That's right.
And so that means
it's part of the default install. And so there's two things you can do. One, there's a setting that turns off advertising, if you call it that, in the start menu. I, of course, immediately did that. And then you can right-click and unpin it. And if you want to, you can uninstall it. I just did. I just checked because I was hard to find something, but I found a solitaire entry. It wasn't on my tiles, but it was in the menu still, and I uninstalled it. And it's just like that, and it's gone. So, okay. Woody may not be really a fan of Windows 10. There is some disinformation that gets spread. I don't think Windows 10, I don't think Microsoft is as bad as, I mean, look, I only have one machine left with Windows 10 on it, so I can answer questions like this, but right. I far prefer Linux, but it's not that bad. You can remove those.
Okay, so for what it's worth, for people who are using Windows 10 and are technically sophisticated, I have here in the show notes a detailed itemization of the group policies which had been removed from Windows 10 Pro. They still exist in the educational version, and they exist in the enterprise version. They are gone from Windows 10 Pro. They used to be there. They've just been taken out. So you're no longer allowed to turn off the Microsoft consumer experience. You cannot turn off showing Windows tips. You have less control over the lock screen, and you're no longer able to prevent changing the log screen and the logon image, nor can you disable all apps from the Windows Store, which are features that the other versions of Windows don't support. So if anyone is curious and wants more details, I've got it all laid out here in the show notes. And then Mary Jo, finally, you know, we talked last week about the whole assistive upgrade backdoor. Mary Jo reported that, I wanted to share this information with our listeners who might find it useful, that Windows 7 and 8 unused product keys can still be used to install Windows 10.
Yeah, I saw that. That's cool.
Yeah. So she has, you know, she asked Microsoft, like, okay, do you guys know about this? And they said, no comment. And she said, well, okay. Is it going to go away? No comment. And so, for what it's worth, she said, and this is last week, she said, in spite of the official end of the free Windows 10 update offer on July 29th, it seems that any valid Windows 7 or 8.x retail product key still installs Windows 10 for now. And again, this is sort of off the books behavior, not what anyone is expecting. And so no idea how long that will last. And so she has, you know, she's verified with Microsoft that this is happening and users are able to install Windows 10 using Windows 7 and 8. Now, and I said unused product keys, but it looks like even valid product keys. So so that, again, also. Apple has changed their, and they announced this just last week on Thursday, at Black Hat. This is Ivan Krstic. Is that how you pronounce his name, Leo? Do you know? K-R-S-T-I-C, Krstic?
Yeah, it's either Krstic anyway, or Krstic. I don't know.
Okay. He announced a reversal of Apple's longstanding "we don't pay bug bounties" policy with the news that Apple will begin offering cash bounties of up to $200,000 to researchers who discover vulnerabilities in its products. And I know you guys just talked about this on Mac Break.
Yeah, and I like the rationalization. Keep going.
Yeah. Well, and to me, it makes sense because what Apple was saying previously was that you know they weren't going to be in a bidding war with government institutions. For example, we know that. That the FBI reportedly, or I it's a rumor, but it's generally agreed that they paid something near $1 million for that hack, which allowed them to get into Syed Farouk's work-related iPhone after the San Bernardino shootings. So a CEO of Securosis, Rich Mogul, he said, "A bug bounty program is unlikely to tempt any hackers who are only interested in getting a massive payout. For those who only care about cash, Apple could probably never pay enough." You know, meaning they wouldn't be able to outbid somebody who had a nefarious application for a breach. But for those who care about making an impact, getting a check from Apple could make all the difference by incentivizing good work. And to me, that makes sense. In fact, and so I paraphrased it. I said, put another way, if you have no interest in allowing your work to be used for evil, but you would like your important security findings to be rewarded and supported, that can now happen on Apple platforms. From my standpoint, I think it makes absolute sense for Apple to say, you know, we'll pay a reasonable amount of money because and as I understand it, part of this is a whole change in their approach to security researchers, right, Leo? They're like saying we'd like to work with people to find problems.
Good idea.
What a concept!
I don't know if this is in the release you're reading, but I didn't read this. Renee reported it. They said, "Well, it's getting so hard to find problems in Apple software now that we want to reward you for doing that."
Yes.
Now are they saying it was easy before, so we didn't want to reward you? I'm not sure what they're saying.
Well, and we keep seeing rootkit hacks. Yeah. No matter what Apple does. In fact, we just had that 9.3.3 went to 9.3.4 to remove another way of getting into the phone. So it's like, good luck. You know, I mean, again, we know these things are just too complicated. The harder you press, the more problems you can find. I think this is great. I'm glad that Apple is saying, yeah, if, you know, white hat hackers, I mean, you know, this stuff does take time. It's, you know, I look at this kind of stuff and I think, wow, that would be fun to do. But I don't have a couple months to find a big problem and then say, here, Apple, and have them fix it. It's like, okay, you know, if it were a profit center and I didn't have a lot of other things to do, then I think that'd be a really fun way to hack. So I think it's great.
Yeah, after all, don't you want, I mean, as users, don't we want Apple to incent people to try to find bugs?
Yeah. 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 I mean, the whole pwn to own competition that happens, which is finding all these problems. And, you know, they're all responsibly disclosed and they're fixed by the time we find them. But until we found them, they were potential 0 days that nobody knew about. So there are an Adam Donenfeld of Checkpoint presented at DEF CON. His presentation was titled "Stumping the Mobile Chipset." And the little synopsis of his presentation read, "Following recent security issues discovered in Android, Google made a number of changes to tighten security across its fragmented landscape. However, Google is not alone in the struggle to keep Android safe. Qualcomm, a supplier of 80% of the chipsets in the Android ecosystem, has almost as much effect on Android security as Google. With this in mind, we decided to closely examine Qualcomm's code in Android devices. During our research, we found multiple privilege escalation vulnerabilities in multiple subsystems introduced by Qualcomm to all its Android devices in multiple, and this is a little redundant, multiple different subsystems. In this presentation, they write, we will review not only the privilege escalation vulnerabilities we found, but also demonstrate and present a detailed exploitation overcoming all the existing mitigations in Android's Linux kernel to run kernel code, elevating privileges, and thus gaining root privilege and completely bypassing SE Linux, which of course is the security enhanced Linux. So they gave that presentation. All versions of Android were vulnerable to these newly revealed flaws. However, they had been trickling the news out responsibly since April, and from April through last month. And so most of them have been fixed. In the supply chain, Google fixed all but one, which was unable to make it into the August updates. So it'll be in the September updates. These flaws affect Android phones and tablets that ship with Qualcomm chips, which could let a hacker take full control of an affected device. And I had a list of the phones somewhere. Oh, there. Google's Nexus 5X, Nexus 6, 6P, HTC's One M9 and HTC 10, and Samsung's Galaxy S7 and just the S7. And I love this too. And the recently announced BlackBerry DTEK50, which of course BlackBerry touts as the most secure Android smartphone. And as we've often said, that's just marketing speak. You know, no one can declare something the most secure anything. They can declare their intent, but it's, as we have learned, because security are mistakes, you don't deliberately make mistakes. That's why it's a mistake. And those mistakes create vulnerabilities that can then be exploited, which sort of tautologically says you can't say it's the most secure phone because, you know, it's not a statement that contains any sense. So these are malicious software install exploits, meaning that somebody would, a malicious actor would need to sneak an app either past Google's scrutiny or the user would have to be incented. And unfortunately, we've just seen this. We were talking about this with Pokemon Go, that people were installing it sideways into their phone by deliberately turning off the, you know, only install apps from the Google Play Store, turning that off in order to install something that wasn't available. So we know that that's being done. But anyway, this is not something like stage fright, where just someone sending you an MMS can take over your phone. This requires you to install some software. However, that software, that Android application, needs no special privileges at all. It doesn't need to ask for anything. It can look completely benign, yet using these exploits, it's able to essentially get root on your phone and then, you know, have the run of the kingdom, do anything that it wants to. A lot of them are in the process of being fixed and will be fixed. The final one from Google by in the next month's batch of patches. We've talked often about just the tracking technology, whether you're concerned about tracking and being tracked or not. Separate, it is, in my mind, separable from this, the technology, which is often fascinating. And I do find myself jarred when I go to a site whose ads are shockingly relevant. I mean, there's a substance that I'm exploring for the healthy sleep formula, known as oleamide. It's looking very good. I haven't said anything about it or written anything about it yet, but it looks like it's another major step forward. It already exists in us. And so I have been purchasing some in order to experiment with it, as have a bunch of other people that are in a small group. And I'm finding the ads for it like in random places that I visit. And it's like, okay, just too weird. I mean, so it, you know, I'm sure everyone has this experience. Unless you are really crazy about, you know, blocking cookies and private browsing and flushing everything. Actually, this exploit still affects you even in private browsing and can be used to track you through a VPN and across a private browsing session. What happened is that some time ago, the W3C ratified you're not going to believe this, a battery status API for HTML5. It's been in Firefox since version 16, and it's in Chrome and Opera, not in Safari or IE. So this is not an issue for them. But for example, you know, Chrome browsers on Android, that would be a place where you would have a battery. The battery API allows a website to determine whether the phone is currently charging or not, the current battery level as a floating point value between 0 and 1.0, for empty to full, if it's charging, the number of seconds remaining until it's expected to reach full charge, and if it's discharging, the number of seconds remaining until it's expected to fully discharge. Now, sure, you could see how that could be handy. A website could, if you were like going to start playing a video, it might check to see whether your phone is on a charger or not. And if it's not, is there a remaining charge in the battery to watch the movie? And if not, it could say, hey, by the way, if you're going to like watch this uninterrupted, you ought to plug the phone in. Now, that would be a little unnerving to us privacy-related people who think, wait a minute, how does this website know that my phone is not plugged in or how much charge my battery has? Maybe that's not a concern. However, think about it. It's yet another thing which is not changing rapidly, or you could argue is changing in a predictable fashion. Like even whether it's charging or discharging, if it's not either fully charged, well, I guess it can't be fully discharged or you wouldn't be using it on the web, but if it's not fully charged, then it's going to be, you know, this time in seconds is going to be ticking down as it charges, or up or down as well. Anyway, you know what I mean. So it turns out that some researchers, two Princeton University researchers, were just curious whether anyone had decided to leverage this for tracking. And of course, we know the answer to that. Yes, they found in the wild ads which are running JavaScript, which are querying the battery status API and using it and like merging it with other tracking related material in order to enhance the integrity of their tracking. And, you know, we talked a long time ago about the Panopticlick site, where a whole bunch of browser headers are munged together and you're sort of ranked, like whether you're unique with your browser or how many other people who are probably not you have been seen with the same fingerprint. It, you know, it basically is a way of fingerprinting you without using explicit tracking technology like a cookie that was never really designed for tracking, but makes it drop dead simple to do. Instead, they're using these sort of side channel approaches for locking onto us. So now we have the battery status API as one more thing. I think it's kind of cool that a website could like help you out, maybe show your phone's battery gauge or use it in some clever fashion or remind you that, you know, it's really not the way lithium ion cells want to be handled to be discharged fully. We see that you only have 5% charge left. If that's your habit, you should consider plugging your phone in more often, and the battery that is not interchangeable will last longer. So, again, another example of something for good not necessarily being used the way its designers intended. Fooling the Tesla's sensors. To me, this is interesting, sort of maybe stick a pin in the map, but I don't think this is a big deal. Chinese researchers working with some people from University of South Carolina demonstrated at DEF CON using off-the-shelf radio sound, meaning ultrasonic, and light-emitting tools, the technology to both spoof the presence of non-existent obstacles and mask the presence of real objects in the car's path. And so, you know, and they're saying, you know, well, you know, we're just demonstrating this academically, but imagine how bad guys could use it. And it's like, to me, it's no one ever imagined that this technology was unspoofable. The car is doing the best it can. I'm still amazed that, you know, anyone is taking their eyes off the road or their hands off the wheel. I know you're not supposed to, but I'm amazed that this technology has just sort of exploded onto the scene as quickly as it has.
You have cruise control in your car, right? Actually, I don't know what you have in your car. I don't even know what kind of car you drive, but
I'm able to push a button and it holds the speed that I'm currently
going. You wouldn't
going.
Take your hands off the wheel if you had cruise control turned on. You'd keep your eye on the road. So it's three things. It's a smarter cruise control that adapts to maintain a good stopping distance, and you can set the stopping distance. So if the car in front of you slows down, you slow down. If it comes to a stop, you come to a stop.
To create a buffer zone.
Yeah, it's called an adaptive cruise control. My Audi did that. The second thing is it will stay in its lane. So if it can see lane markings, which it can't always, but most of the time on the highway it can, it will, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, it stays right in the middle of that lane.
Right.
And then, so both of those, I think, are minor. My Audi didn't steer, but it would warn you. It would pre-tension the seatbelts and vibrate the wheel. So that's not new. The one thing that's a little weird is you can turn on the blinker and the car will go into the change lanes for you.
That's nice.
But if you think about it, self-parking is similar, right?
Yep. And you know, when you mentioned the blinker, it's a pet peeve of mine that I'm a crazy blinker user, and I'm like alone.
You're the only one I know, especially in Southern California. Yeah.
No one. They just don't bother.
No.
And sort of
I was taught as I learned how to drive when the public schools still taught you how to drive. They don't anymore, by the way. There's no driver's training. But the driver's training guy teacher, and it stayed in my head all my whole life, still does, said, even if you're signaling to, as a convenience, the person behind you, give them some warning, even if it's it's obvious you're going to turn or there's nobody behind you, just get in the habit. And yes, I did. And yes, I still have that habit, but a lot of people apparently were taught. Yeah, it's a courtesy. That's what he said. It's a courtesy. Let them know. And so, yeah, and you can't change lanes without doing that on the Tesla, I guess.
It would be nice if we knew that the person blinking was going to do what they said they were going to do.
Right.
Because, of course, you still have to make sure that they're not going to, you know, keep on.
As I get older, I realize I'm just going to leave the blinker on. I feel like, why turn it off? You know what I'm saying?
You know, Leo, you can use that emergency flasher button and everything blinks.
I'm turning eventually.
Then you're covered.
I'm going to be turning. Just a little early.
You haven't decided which direction, so
I don't
flash
know.
Them both.
No, I'm not sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That'll keep everybody confused. And they'll give you lots of margin, too. They'll plenty of leeway.
I have that left turn signal going the whole time. The whole time. Just to, you know, you never know. No, actually, the Tesla.
My breath.
Okay, yeah, we'll do that. I'll just, you know, the Tesla, I think you'd have to really be kind of strange and cocky and maybe overestimating what's going on. It's pretty apparent. It's not really driving itself. And, man, I mean, every time I use it, and I do use it a lot, I'm paying just as much attention to what's going on. I'm just letting it help
I think not everyone is us.
Right.
And that's a problem.
We use blinkers. So, right there, we've established.
Right. Yeah.
We're weird. Our show today brought to you by my doorbell, the Ring Video Doorbell. Love the Ring Video Doorbell. It does not have a jingle. It has more like a chime, actually. Let me, it's like this. That's the sound that I hear when my doorbell rings. You know what's cool? I hear it on my phone. I hear it on my tablet. I hear it on my Mac. I hear it in my Windows machine because Ring is an internet-connected doorbell. And even better, it doesn't just have, you know, the internet connection for ringing. It has inside the Ring doorbell an HD camera, wide angle, and speaker and microphone. So I can actually answer the door. I can see who's standing there. In fact, I can even see who's on my front lawn. Get off of my lawn! I actually do that a lot, just for fun. Get off of my lawn! With the Ring video doorbell, you will not be surprised ever again. And it also keeps track of the coming and going in your house. If you've got teenagers, you now have full evidence of everything going on when they come and go. I want you to check out the Ring video doorbell. It's a security thing. It's a convenience. It's a must-have. And right now they're doing a Ring of Security bundle that is really awesome. Let me go to ring.com/security now, and I can show you this bundle because it's awesome. You get to choose between two different bundles depending on your needs. The original Ring had a big lithium-ion battery in it, which made it very useful if you're going to put it somewhere where there wasn't a wired doorbell previously. In fact, I could have used that because I replaced my wired doorbell. So in that case, you might want to get the Pro kit, 720p for the original, 1080p for the Pro, plus it's slimmer and prettier because it doesn't have the battery in it because it's presuming you have a wired doorbell. Both kits include the stick-up cam. They call it that. Well, it does avoid stick-ups, I guess, but the real reason is you can stick it up. It's completely wireless, Wi-Fi enabled, and if you'll also get the solar panel that you connect to the stick-up cam, and now you're good to go. I mean, it's awesome. The stick-up cam has the same capabilities as a Ring doorbell, so you can talk to somebody who's behind your house, on the side of your house. It's the Ring of Security kit. They even throw in the Ring chime, which you could plug into any socket, connect to your Wi-Fi, and then that will ring along with the ding-dongers in your hall, which, you know, is a useful thing. I'm getting older. I miss a lot of doorbells. Frankly, that's why we got the Ring. People come to my door, and I would never hear them. So now I could put that in the gym or out in the back, in the potting shed where I do my potting, and that'll ring, and I'll know there's somebody at the doorbell. I don't even have to go to the front door. I could just take out my phone and say, yeah, what do you want? Your package? Oh, just leave it right there. Russell uses that. Russell, our IT guy, as you would imagine, he gets a lot of expensive packages delivered to his office. And because he's a contract IT guy, he's rarely there. So he uses the Ring. When they ring the doorbell, he says, the code to get in is 3712. Could you just put it inside the door? And they do it. It's awesome. It's awesome. Look, you got to get it. The Ring video doorbell. If you want the Ring of Security bundle, $50 off if you go to ring.com/security now. ring.com/security now. We love this. And as we talked about before, the Ring does over-the-air updates. So there was a security issue. A security researcher, before revealing it publicly, told Ring about it. It was, you know, somebody could take the doorbell off, pry it off your door, and then plug it into his USB port and get your Wi-Fi password off of it. They fixed it before anybody even knew about it. Before it went public, they pushed an update. Firmware updates are automatic. It's just awesome. Ring.com/security now.
And it also updates upon installation.
Right.
So the moment you set it up, it's going to get itself updated to the latest.
This company is just the beginning. When Richard Branson, and he just led a round of $28 million investment in this, they were saying, yeah, because Richard's seen what we're doing next. There's some really cool stuff coming. These guys are awesome. I'm very happy to have them as an advertiser on Security Now. Ring.com/security.
Well, yeah. And this also demonstrates that it's not the Internet of Things per se which is the problem. It's the land rush by companies not qualified to do that securely that are messing things up.
Right.
And so, you know, as we've talked about, you know, crazy returning a camera and then still being able to log into it after somebody else buys it. It's like,
you want to buy from a reputable company who understands the issues, the security issues, and make sure that they take care not to make you subject to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's encrypt. Everybody knows what a fan I am of the idea of automating the least least verified class of certificates, which, while being least verified, still makes them incredibly useful. You know, the so-called DV, the domain validation certificate for a web server, where the only thing it's claiming is that I am the server for this domain. There's no corporate association, no, you know, company reputation, you know, nothing more than I'm a server on this domain. I mean, it's sort of obvious when you think about it. And so the beauty of what Let's Encrypt does is it allows those certificates to be made available in an automated fashion at no cost, thus moving the whole web from HTTP to HTTPS to encrypt all of what was plain text. So all kinds of problems. Like, I mean, looking back on it now, it's hard it's hard to believe that we were in a period during this podcast where you would log on to Facebook with a secure connection, and then it would then drop you back to a non-secure connection, that is a non-private, non-encrypted connection, where your Facebook session was maintained by a cookie being sent in the clear.
Fire sheep.
Yeah. It's like, you know, did we ever actually do that?
It's kind of amazing.
The whole industry did that. So, anyway.
We've come a long way. We've learned.
We really have.
Yeah.
We really have. And in fact, didn't we just hear that, what was it? It was like last week was the 25th anniversary of the first web page that was delivered probably by, you know, at CERN. By what's his name?
Tim Berners-Lee.
Yes, Tim Berners-Lee. Yep, 25 years.
Can you believe that? The first web page. Wow.
And here we are closing in on 11 year of the podcast. Yeah. So we've been around for a chunk of that time.
Wasn't it the 35th anniversary of the IBM PC as well?
Yes. And by the way, I heard you ask who had a 5150.
Did you?
I had a 50. Absolutely.
The original? Did you have the cassette port and the cassette adapter?
No, I came along. Well, because I was in.
Because originally it did not have a hard drive or a. It had a cassette adapter, right?
It had dual floppies.
Dual floppies and a cassette adapter.
There was an audio, you know, microphone and earphone plug in the back, so that you could store your 12-line BASIC program. I don't know who they thought was going to buy this thing with a cassette player. But, and that it had a choice of either a color or a monochrome display. The color display was, I don't know who designed it, but it flickered like crazy because the, you know, while the CRT is scanning, it's having to, in order to scan the screen, it's reading out of the memory for the video. And there wasn't enough bandwidth, you know, to the memory for the video to read from the refresh memory at the same time that the computer, the 4.77 megahertz 8088, or was it 8086? I don't remember in the very first one, when it was updating the video. So you had a choice. You could either not give the video screen access to the video memory when the processor needed it, which would cause a little blurch to appear. And what you got was a screen full of static while the page was being updated. It was just sort of snow. And then IBM said, oh, no, no, it looks broken. We can't ship it that way. So some great bright engineer said, oh, we'll turn off the video. We just won't let them see the snow. So they blank the video while the system is updating, like when it scrolls. In order to scroll the screen, you have to copy all of the data. You had an ASCII byte and then a color byte. And you had, so 16 bits per character. You'd have to copy them up by, in this case, 160 bytes, which is 2 times an 80-character line. So you'd have to copy this 4K buffer up by 160 characters. So basically move the entire buffer in order to scroll. Well, it looked like a blizzard. So they turn the video off, copy everything up, then turn it back on. Then what you got, if you did like a directory listing, it would just flash as it was scrolling upwards. So of course, my first product for the IBM PC was called Flicker Free. It redesigned
vertical blank, right?
Did you use it, well, blank? It did a non-blanking flicker. It turns out that something that apparently the IBM engineers hadn't noticed is that it was a Motorola video display chip, so it's a 68 something or other. There was a register that contained the starting address of the video memory. Well, they left it at zero, but it turns out if you change the starting address to 160, suddenly with no flicker at all, the entire video buffer has just moved up with no flicker.
Just now, you're jumping the buffer.
Instead of moving the buffer, I was moving
the pointer,
the region that was being refreshed.
Yeah.
And it got a little tricky at the end because video memory wrapped around,
right.
Yet it wasn't a multiple of the page size. So I had to do a bunch of other things. You know, nothing is ever as easy as the top level description. But bottom line was, not only did it eliminate the flicker, but because you weren't having to copy the memory, it scrolled instantly. And so people who are used to seeing their display go, it just shot by. Anyway, so we sold a lot of Flicker Free, and that's what allowed
that's
me to
cool.
then have time to write SpinWrite.
I didn't know that actually.
Yeah,
I thought I knew everything about it.
So yeah, I had one of the big steel IBM boxes in the beginning. Anyway, Let's Encrypt is taken off like crazy. We've talked about what a success it has been. The problem initially has been who's going to trust their cert, because they're needing to issue certificates on the fly using this confirmable API that allows a web server to automate the process of interacting with the automated certificate authority to issue its own certificates. So what was done initially, and we discussed this at the time, was cross-signing the certificate, meaning that they did create, the Let's Encrypt people created their own root certificate, which upon launch no browsers knew about. So it didn't do them any good. But they also had their certificate. So the certificates they were issuing were all being signed by their own root cert that, again, nobody recognized, and also by an old school major certificate authority that everybody knew, a process called cross signing. So it was double signed. The news is that Firefox has just recently pushed the ISRG X1. ISRG, what is that? Internet Security Research Group, I think. X1 root cert is now through debugging, and I've got, in, if anyone's curious for details, links in the show notes to the dialogue where it's been accepted as, you know, everything is called a bug, even when it's not a bug. That's just, they just use the bug system to move updates through and manage it. So it's been managed, and I expect before long we will have a production version of Firefox that natively recognizes this ISRG X1 root cert. And at some point, there's like nothing wrong with cross-signing. At some point, after all the browsers have come up to speed and have that root cert in all of their stores, then Let's Encrypt can drop the signing by the other certificate authority and have it only signed by their own, because theirs will be recognized. So another nice milestone for this terrific project. And LastPass, I had to mention, because a lot of our listeners sent me the news that they have produced an authenticator app. And so this is
I'm sorry.
What?
You touched a button. First of all, they came out with that a while ago. But just this week, they decided to pester the hell out of us about it. That's why everybody's sending you notes. Is it driving you crazy too?
So, well, what's clever about it? So, I should mention that it's the time-based one-time password that we've talked about.
It's like Google Authenticator
Google Authenticator, like the old football that we talked about years ago. What's a little different, though, is that it knows about the LastPass browser extension so that you don't have to type anything. When you use their authenticator and you're a LastPass user, which is probably the only reason you'd have the LastPass authenticator, and LastPass, your LastPass extension is logged into your browser. That is, when everything's like set up to go, and you visit a site that wants a 6-digit code, the extension will see that. It will push a request to the phone. The authenticator pops up, showing you the 6 digits, but you don't have to enter anything. You simply say, yes, I want to use it to authenticate. And the 6 digits are sent back to the browser app, which then populates the field on the site that you're visiting, and you're logged in.
And this, by the way, is exactly why I didn't use it. I don't want a single source for the authentication and the password manager. Because if one is compromised, then I'm giving them both, right? I didn't want to use an authenticator.
They're coming from a single manufacturer.
Yeah, well, if LastPass is compromised, then they get the password and the second factor. So that's why I don't use LastPass Authenticator. And I wish they'd stop bugging me about it. Because every time it pops up saying, oh, you know, if you were using LastPass Authenticator, and there isn't even a close box on the pop-up, you have to go into a menu to close it. It's incredibly annoying.
Well,
and I think it's less secure. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think having a single provider do both is the right way to do it. I understand what you're saying. I'd still have to be authenticated and logged in as LastPass, but let's say I've been compromised.
Well, okay. The reason I'm hesitating is I'm just sort of running through the logic, because you still have an app running on a mobile device. And so that gives you
No, it's
you
not
some
on your, it's in your browser.
No. The authenticator is on your phone.
Oh, I misunderstood. Okay. So the so I did install this by the way, like a couple of months ago. I installed the LastPass authenticator. But the problem is you're setting up the authenticator with your LastPass credentials, are you not? Maybe I misunderstood it. I just like the idea of using a separate company with a separate database for my second
You're
factor.
Completely right. If the way it worked was that LastPass browser extension was the authenticating agent so that it populated the six digits, then I'm 100% with you. But that's not what this is.
Okay, good. Because I use the new Google authentication, which sends a notification to your phone, and then you accept it.
This is that.
Okay.
That's all that they've done.
Okay.
They've done exactly the same thing.
Then I'll turn that on. I had, you know what, maybe this is new because they did something a little different when they first did it. It looked like basically another Google authenticator, and it didn't have that wiring.
And you know, Leo, just to be honest, what you're reporting in terms of being bugged,
that bugs me.
That's not something Joe would have done.
No.
No, we never had that before.
An ad for another product popping up whenever I use LastPass? That's a very log me in kind of thing to do.
That's exactly my
point. Not happy about that.
It does support time-based six-digit codes, what they're calling one-tap push notifications.
Yeah, that's the thing I like. That must be new. I do like that because I use that with Google, and it really is convenient, much more convenient than entering the six-digit code. All right, good.
Well, we're getting so spoiled. I have to
too
type
much work.
Those pesky six digits. I can only remember five. I have to keep going back.
That's kind of part of my argument is it shouldn't be easy, right? It should be hard.
Oh, I've got something coming that's easy, Mr.
Okay. Like a squirrel.
I've got something. So I wanted to tell our listeners that GRC's DNS spoofability test is back up. I didn't realize until I inadvertently killed it a couple of months ago how many people used it. It is very cool, and there's nothing else like it on the planet. And I'm proud of it. And it was a huge investment of time. And after I was done, I thought, well, it's beautiful, but why did I spend all this time? And I'm really hoping I don't feel that way about Squirrel. So we'll see. But this thing, it died. The reason I'm bringing it up, first of all, I just wanted to let everyone know it's back. What happened is I use DNS in a very clever way for GRC's version checking. That is the other thing, the DNS benchmark. People who use the DNS benchmark all the time started complaining. He says, hey, it says it can't tell if there's a new version. What happens is I have what I call a pseudo DNS server that I wrote at GRC. And so domain names can be special. For example, DNS bench. .ver.grc.com looks like a domain name, and it returns an IP address, which is actually the least significant two pieces of the application of the most recent version of the application's version number. And what's nice about that is that it's not TCP, it's super low overhead. Anything lets you do DNS, even behind a portal or something. So it tends to get out, and all it's doing is apparently making a single DNS request. So it's just a beautiful, lightweight way of checking versioning. Well, I had to add that to Squirrel, the GRC Squirrel client. I mean, we're at that point now where I'm in the final details of this stuff. And so I knew that the DNS system had broken, a few months ago because we were getting complaints about it. But it's like, yeah, I'm busy and you know, I'll get to it. But the complaints kept coming in. So I'm gratified that people are finding the DNS spoofability test to be as useful as they are. And it's getting use. That's neat. What happened was weird. And it put me in mind of that Cujo appliance we talked about a couple weeks ago because I inadvertently Cujo'd myself when I when I brought up that the new FreeBSD Unix server, for a reason I don't yet know, even now, I know the problem is I don't know what's causing it. And it's bizarre, but it's claiming an IP that it doesn't own, which happens to be an IP that it gets mapped internally to the incoming DNS responses or the incoming DNS queries. So DNS comes in to a name server at GRC, and that Unix machine continues sending out what's called a gratuitous ARP. Now, normally the way address resolution protocol works is that when something on an Ethernet needs to know what network adapter to send a packet to based on its IP, remember Ethernet is the numbering, the labeling, the addressing is the word I'm looking for. The addressing on Ethernet is MAC addresses, these 48-bit MAC addresses, which are where the most significant 24 bits is a manufacturer number, and the least significant 24 is a serial number of that manufacturer. The idea being that you don't need to have jumpers or switches or anything, that there will never be more than that many Ethernet adapters on the same network, certainly, but the idea is never in the world. So you can just plug them onto an Ethernet and you don't ever have to worry about address collision. So ARP says it's a broadcast message that says who has IPX. And so all the adapters on the so-called broadcast domain, which is typically the whole Ethernet, but that's something that VLANs are able to segment. All of the adapters that hear that, they check their little list of IPs. And you know how adapters can have more than one IP. This is how you can have multiple IPs on a single computer or adapter, is they just have a list. And if somebody is asking who has this IP, the adapter that has been configured with that IP says, I do. And so it responds. So there's an ARP request and an ARP reply. Well, the other thing that can happen is what is happening in this case, and that is a gratuitous ARP is, as the name sort of implies, it's a statement that like nobody asked for, but the owner is just sort of saying it, and that's handy. So like when an interface comes up when you're booting a system for the first time, and the networking system comes up, that NIC, the network interface controller, can send gratuitous ARPs for all the IPs that it owns. And so what happens is any switches which are on the network will receive those gratuitous ARPs and go, oh, nice to know. So you save them the overhead of asking when something wants to come in, that it sets up their ARP table automatically. So what was happening was this Unix machine is every second or two sending out a gratuitous ARP for an IP completely unassociated with it. I'm tempted to think this is a bug. I mean, and what's interesting is I have three Unix machines. The oldest one is behaving itself and is not doing this. Both the one I set up recently to handle GRC's forthcoming web forums and the free NAS server, they're both doing it. The free NAS server wasn't causing problems, even though it's also doing it. It's claiming an IP on the same switch port, so it doesn't cause the switch to send the traffic out the wrong port. So it's bad, but it's not disruptive, which is why I'm thinking maybe there's a bug that nobody has. I mean, because you wouldn't notice it unless you were in this weird situation where the machine was claiming an IP on a different switch port, thus disrupting traffic that should have gone out that switch port, sending it over to its. And the point is, this is how the Cujo works. Remember, we talked about it. This thing that you just plug into your network, and somehow it's able to take over. It's able to do a man in the middle attack, essentially, benignly. But the idea is, it sends out gratuitous ARPs in order to claim to be the gateway for the network. So all the devices send their traffic to it rather than to the actual gateway. Anyway, so for what, I thought that was a little interesting backstory, and just wanted to let everybody know that the GNS spoofability test, GRC's DNS spoofability test, is back online. And now and the DNS benchmark is happy again. It's able to see what its version is, and now I can write the code to add it to the Squirrel client, so it'll be able to let people know if I've got a new version of the Squirrel client. And one last, or actually two last bits. A follower, Justin Garrison, he has been following our conversation about the, from a Q&A a couple of weeks ago, the listener who was wondering about using Firefox as a non-corporate intercepted proxied web browser. And he reminded me that the portable version of Firefox maintains its cert store on its portable medium. So if you install the portable version of Firefox, for example, on a USB drive, you can, and if your corporation allows a non-proxied browser to have access, that's another way of avoiding anyone messing around with its certificate store, because it's you know, it's off on its own and is only present when you're using the browser. So thank you, Justin, for the tip, and for anyone else who might find that useful. It's nice to have the option of something like that, a fully self-contained little portable Firefox, instead of, for example, I was suggesting a VM as a means of creating containment, but this is probably even cleaner. And it's, you know, not something you probably need to have all the time and wouldn't take up any space on your system. And Leo.
Steve.
Stranger Things.
Oh, you watched it? Did I tell you to watch it?
Yes, you mentioned it. Well, okay. You mentioned it kind of diffidently, and
well,
I just
like
had to
tell
say,
you shows if you don't like them, I don't want to.
It's the best thing I've ever seen in my life.
Oh my gosh,
which
you liked
maybe
it?
Maybe is a little hyperbolic. So I will say, I was rehearsing this, and it is one of the best things I have ever seen.
Good.
I absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
It's a fabulous miniseries. I call it that because it's 8 episodes. They're like an hour and 50 minutes each. Netflix has done it again. I just bit my tongue until halfway through episode 7. I kept waiting to see if it was going to disappoint me, if it was going to fail, if you know. And finally, I said, "Okay, I can't wait any longer." So I tweeted out an absolute unreserved recommendation.
Nice.
I mean, it's worth joining Netflix for, and they've raised the price now to $10.
Yeah.
Joining them for a month just to get this, and then you know, quit your subscription if there's nothing else that you find interesting. It is really good.
So, it's interesting because it's had a slow start. It's like they didn't promote it or something. But the word of mouth has been spectacular. So,
And you were onto it pretty quickly. It was July 15th that it was released.
Yeah.
So only the middle of last month.
People are discovering it now, though.
It's a 9.2, which I don't think I've ever seen on IMDb. It's a 90-something, maybe 92-something in Rotten Tomatoes.
Good.
I consider it when I was trying to like characterize it, I called it a cross between Goonies, Super 8, and Close Encounters.
Exactly. It's self-consciously so, because it's an 80s homage.
Right. But also it starts out as sort of a mystery. You know, it opens with a star field, and you slowly pan down to this dark mysterious looking laboratory with some satellite dishes and some red lights up on poles. And, you know, the music is well done.
Music's really well done. I loved the music.
It's fabulous. Yeah. But then the way it successively reveals what's going on, also there is always a problem that it's not going to hold together. That is like the writers cheated or, you know, something impossible happens. That doesn't happen. So the whole, once you really understand what's going on, and you don't until very near the end, then you realize how everything fits exactly right. So it has integrity, you know, internal integrity as well, and a fabulous ending. So anyway, I don't know if there will be another one.
I think they did get renewed for a second season. I don't know what they'll do with it. I guess there are a lot of unresolved questions that they could address.
We did have a little tease at the very last scene, so they could do more. Anyway, I loved it, and I know that not everybody follows me on Twitter. So, Leo, thank you for mentioning it.
Good.
I got around to it, and I did it. I stretched it out over two nights.
Yeah, I think we did a few more, but because it's a lot.
Yeah, you know,
it's like six or eight episodes, and
it's eight.
But it's hard to stop watching.
Oh,
yeah.
And I will say, the responses to the tweet were people who were already ahead of me said they absolutely agreed, and then others who my tweet incented came back a few days later and said, "Wow!" So for what it's worth,
great cast, and there's kids. Teenagers and adults, and they each have their own threads, but the kids are the best. They're so good.
Oh, the guy, it's
so
perfect.
Good. I know.
The dialogue, I kept backing up and like watching scenes over a couple times because I sound like Andy going off on something.
If you like
really
Dungeons and Dragons, the Dungeons and Dragons scene, but beware the Gorgon. That was my only negative, was the Gorgon. Little rubbery.
Yeah,
I agree.
I agree.
I'm trying to do this without spoiling anything.
The dumb adults versus the smart kids.
Yeah.
The parents are kind of clueless.
Yeah, poor Winona Ryder didn't really. I mean, all she could do was act freaked out for eight episodes.
And I wouldn't have even recognized her.
I know.
I was very surprised. And I knew from the credits, but it's like, wow, that's Winona.
Stranger Things. It's a Netflix exclusive. You have to have a Netflix account. I think there's enough good stuff on Netflix, and that it's worth the subscription, $10 a month. And by the way, because I have now, I bought a UHD HDR 4K TV. That's the other good thing about Netflix is they have a significant amount of 4K content. And even some HDR content. And you can find it by searching HDR on Netflix. And so even though Marco Polo was the worst series ever, it sure looks good. It's beautiful. Anyway, Stranger Things, Netflix.
Yep.
Without reservation.
Thank
you, yeah.
I don't think anybody could be disappointed. I mean, yeah, there are curmudgeons, but still, if you're not a curmudgeon, if you like the idea,
it's funny.
Something fun.
I don't want to recommend something to you that you hate, so I'm always like a little ginger, and
I can certainly hit, pause.
Something
or stop.
That you kind of like.
But anyway, I'm delighted.
You like this, right? Do you know what this is?
Yes. Oh, I do know what that is. I got mine right. I'm looking at it right now, baby.
Do you want me to take a break? I'll take a real quick break, and then we'll get
perfect.
Back. Drobo. This is a big one. This is the heavy one. This is the Drobo. What is this? The 5N, I think is what it is. The NAS?
Yes, it is the 5N. Yeah, the 5N.
This thing is awesome, but all Drobos are awesome. They share. It's a family of storage arrays for protecting your data, systems that connect directly to your PC or your Mac. Or Linux, by the way. I use it on Linux with USB 3, Thunderbolt 1, or Thunderbolt 2. They also offer network storage for sharing and backing up networks at home or in the office. They were the first, I think, in 2008 for the concept of exposing a server embedded in NAS appliances to developers. So the Drobo Apps program was really a hit. Developers came up with a bunch of apps. Other NAS vendors are doing it, but Drobo really started it. So this is the 5N. There's also the 810.
You get a bash shell.
Yeah.
It's
incredible. The real deal.
And WordPress runs on it.
I know. I know. It's awesome. This is my 5N. And you get a full LAMP stack. You get Node.js. You get WordPress, as you mentioned. You can use, developers can use C or Go or Perl or Python or Ruby. There's a Git client, so you can use it for Git. Steve, we're going to get you using Git someday, one of these days. There's a SDK, Complete Software Development Kit. You can put Plex on this for streaming media, Mini DLNA and Firefly. That also is a great solution for media. You can use a BitTorrent client for gathering files. You can run your own email server, secure remote access, end-to-end encryption. This is your home cloud. The MyDrobo and Drobo Access apps let you access your data from any computer using a web browser or on your phone, iOS or Android, or your tablet. Data is encrypted end-to-end, Steve Gibson TNO style, so you have complete privacy, and the MyDrobo and Drobo Access apps are built using well-known, well-vetted open-source solutions like Let's Encrypt, Own Cloud, and PageKite. That's the software, but the hardware stack is just as amazing. So this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 disks in an array. It's hot swappable. The disks can be heterogeneous. Unlike RAID, they don't have to all be the same size. You can mix and match, which means this is the way Drobo, I think, took off initially. You could throw any old garbage disk you had lying around in there, and when you run out of room, the lights in the front say, hey, you need to replace this disk. You hot swap in the new disk. It rebuilds. It's not RAID. It's beyond RAID. That's what Drobo calls it. And I am a huge fan. This 5N, of course, has one port on it, an Ethernet port, because you put this in your closet. You hide it away. But, man, I mean, with five drives, you could have 50 terabytes on here. I mean, the sky's the limit. Visit DroboStore.com to learn more and check out their complete line of products. And as a listener, you'll save $100 off the Drobo Mini, which I use also. That's really great. Thunderbolt. Oh, man, I love that. That's for carrying around, like, portable storage. This is not exactly portable.
Oh, that's why it has a bag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Mini's great. This you wouldn't... this you'd carry... You know, the one reason you might, if you had two of them, you keep one at home and one at work, you could have off-site kind of...
But, or you could do if it you were like major video editing content, you might need to bring it, schlep to it around.
Yeah, but that's what the mini does so well, because it takes the littler drives. You could put SSDs in there. And as Steve always likes to mention, speaking of SSDs, you use this little caching NVMe M.2 SSD. It's optional. You don't have to do it. But if you want to really speed up little writes, this thing in here, this is awesome. The little mSATA SSD. Love it. So... $100 off. Go to DroboStore.com. That could be the Drobo Mini, the 5D, the 5N, any 8 or 12 drive system. DroboStore.com. Here's the offer code. Ready? Write this down. TWIT100. TWIT100 for $100 off at DroboStore.com. We love the Drobo. I am in Drobo heaven. As you know, I'm doing my own cloud at home, and having the Drobo there, it makes it so much easier. And it gives me unlimited storage. It's really awesome. Drobo store.com. TWIT100, the offer code. All right, Steve.
So I wanted to mention that I did bring myself up to speed on what this Beyond RAID is.
I was very interested to hear about this.
Yeah. And also what they mean when they say thin provisioning. First of all, the thin provisioning... essentially it means when you create multiple volumes, you don't need to pre-declare the size of each volume. In the old days, we had hard drives we still have hard drives, fortunately, and partitions. So you can think of a partition, like by the actual name it's been given, a partition of the hard drive. And, you know, you would set things up with C, D, E, and F partitions. That's like the reverse of thin provisioning, because the point is that you have to decide ahead of time how much space to give to C, how much to give to D, and so forth. Now, things have gotten better. Windows, for example, is able to shrink and move partitions, which allows you to make some changes. But what the Drobo does is allows you to, and what they call thin partitioning, is to create multiple accounts which are able to grow at whatever rate they want to grow, and not need to pre-assign any specific amount of space to anyone, but essentially allow them to all pull as they need to from that space. So that's their thin partitioning thing. But the technology that was most interesting to me that I wanted to understand was what they call Beyond RAID. And what I like about this is that what you know, RAID itself, that the abbreviation, redundant array of inexpensive drives, RAID. The concept is that you are protected against the failure. Either a spot can't read or the whole drive can't read, but you're protected against failures by redundantly having information on the drive. So let's take the three drive case. You have two drives that contain different data. So say that you had a 10 megabyte drive and another. Okay, I really am old school. Forget about that. 10 gigabyte drive and another 10 gigabyte drive. And they've got different data. They have different data. So it's not, they're not, the data is not in any way related. Now you take a third drive. And what's really cool about the XOR function is you XOR the data sector for sector, byte for byte from those two drives. And you store the XOR of them in the third drive. So, what this allows, so now you have a three drive RAID. Now it still only stores 20 gig, right? Because we had two drives, 10 gigs each, and then we added another drive. But what it's doing is storing the XOR of the first two. So that doesn't give you, that doesn't buy you or deliver any more storage space. It's still the total storage is still the two drive sizes, this 20 gigs. But any one of them can fail and you lose nothing. Obviously, that third one, that checksum drive that we added, the XOR drive, that can go away and no one cares. What's cool is since it stores essentially the difference, that's what an XOR is, the difference between the bits in the first and the second drive, if I'm not going to take that drive away, I'll take that drive away. If the first drive goes away, we can infer the contents of the first drive by XORing again the second drive against the XOR drive, and that returns the data that was originally stored in the first drive. So, and what's elegant is that from a computer science standpoint, XOR is very fast. It's incredibly, well, not incredibly, but it's sufficiently fast that you're not losing a huge amount of speed in essentially arranging to, so that whenever you write data to either drive, you update this XOR extra copy that represents the difference. Now, what's really cool is that it works with more than just two drives. You can take three drives as your main, or four drives as your main, or five, and then have one XOR of all the others. And if any one of the others fail, you can reconstruct what it originally had from using the remaining drives. It's going to be slower because you have to read all of them in order to recompute the missing drives' contents, but it works. Now, in an extension to that is RAID 6. I can't do that with my fingers, unfortunately, because it uses some fancier math, but essentially it's an additional drive of redundancy. which also does not buy you more storage, but now it means any two drives can fail and you still can read the whole thing. And RAID 6 is coming into its own because drives are now, drive arrays are getting so big that if a drive dies, if a RAID, in RAID 5, if a drive dies, you have lost all redundancy. It's okay as long as no other drive fails. But the concern now is sometimes it takes days to rebuild a failed RAID when one drive dies because, as I said, it is intensive. You have to read the data on all the other drives in order to reconstruct the one missing drive in a RAID 5. And so if you've got 12 drives, for example, and those are multi-terabyte drives, you know, as I've mentioned before, nobody ever formats a drive any longer. I mean, if you actually gave a format command where it was going to go out and read every sector, you might as well just, I don't know, come up with some way of needing less space because this thing will just never happen. It'll never finish. That's the burden that SpinRite has because it's all about actually reading all of the physical surface. Nothing does that any longer except SpinRite, but that's also what makes it unique and valuable. The point, though, is if you have 12 drives, one of the problems with increasing the drive count is if each drive has a certain probability of failure, the more of those you have, the more likely one of them will fail statistically. So the problem with RAID 5 is that what happens if another drive fails during the rebuild of the first drive that failed? That's why RAID 6 is gaining popularity. It's, you know, drives are cheap and technology is cheap. So let's add one more drive. It won't give us any more space, but it will mean that while rebuilding from a failed drive, if anything else fails, we're still okay. Okay, so that's sort of the RAID background. All that's really, when you think about it, all that's really necessary is that we arrange for redundancy across drives. And what I was curious about from just the overview of what Drobo did is it made it sound like you could remove a drive and if you had, say that you had it populated with five, as I do, as I do mine, you remove a drive and it is, well, and as we know, if that was just RAID 5, standard RAID, I remove a drive and I have now lost all my redundancy because I'm now requiring all of the drives I have to compute the data in the missing drive. And so that's a problem. What Drobo has done is they said, okay, so we're down X terabytes from the drive that's failed. So now we've got four. So, but rather than saying, so we have no redundancy, they say, we're going to restore redundancy as quickly as possible. And when you think about it, nothing actually prevents you, theoretically, from re-rating on the fly. That is, saying to yourself, okay, we only have four drives. We want to restore redundancy. So let's turn this into a four-drive RAID. And they do that, which is very cool. So so what they do is they, when they see a drive is gone, they start rebuilding to restore redundancy. Now, the requirement is free space because what we've seen is that the way this works is you are consuming a whole drive's worth of space for redundancy. So, and the other thing to note, in a three drive RAID, you've got two drives of data and one of overhead. So that's not very efficient. 50 or one third of your total capacity is wasted in this RAID checksum, you know, the XOR drive. So what is nice if with a simple RAID 5 is the more drives you have, the lower the overhead becomes of the redundancy. Because as I said, if you had like 11 drives, I don't have that many fingers, 11 drives and then one of checksum, then, you know, it's now much lower percentage of the total storage. On the other hand, as we saw, with that many drives, the chances of any of them having a problem goes up. So then you begin to want to have additional redundancy. Anyway, so all I wanted to really say was that I'm impressed. The way they pull off this, you know, and we mentioned it before. In fact, last week I talked about a guy who was using SpinRite to recover friends' drives and then copy them to brand new drives, and then he would take that recovered drive home with him. And if it was bigger than any of the drives in his if it was bigger than the smallest of the drives in his Drobo, he'd pull out the small drive and put in the bigger drive. And again, what Drobo does is it has the technology. First of all, unlike other RAIDs, the drives contain metadata that tell Drobo which drive is which. So you're free to rearrange them in the box anytime you want. If I did that on my hardware RAID at level 3, everything would fall apart. It would not recognize the RAID, and it would say it was broken and alarms would go off. Drobo doesn't do that because it tags the drives and tracks them as they move around within the case. But in this case, so you pull out the smaller one, the smallest one, put in one that's larger than that. Drobo recognizes what has happened and then sets about rebuilding itself to optimize the storage that it contains. And you do have a choice of one or two drives of redundancy. That is sort of like drives worth of redundancy. So you can run where, for example, in a five drive box where you get the storage of four of the drives, if you use a single drive redundancy, or you can do dual drive redundancy and be protected if any two die and then have the storage equivalent of three of those drives. So anyway, I did want to dig into it. I haven't seen this technology before. They did it right, and I'm very impressed. So nice piece of work. SpinRite.
Speaking of nice pieces of work, yes.
I found a nice question from somebody who was wondering about ZFS, the Z file system. Trevor Harrison in Vancouver, British Columbia, he said the subject was, with ZFS scrub, is SpinRite still needed on ZFS volumes? He says, hi, Steve. I'm building my first free NAS box. Hanging out in the free NAS IRC channel, I've been told that the ZFS scrub is a block-by-block scrub of the drive to find bad blocks. I know SpinRite works at the sector level below the file system. He says, parens, at the metal level? So can you explain to us and even do a ZFS in-depth podcast as to why ZFS scrub replaces SpinRite or doesn't? I personally think it doesn't. But running SpinRite on a live server with lots of drives, well, you get the idea. I'd like to know for sure and understand the differences. And he says, do you ever SpinRite your GRC servers? And then he says, also, I'll be buying SpinRite as soon as I can hear my Yabba Dabba Doo live. Kind regards, Trevor.
I've actually told you you should have that live. I told you.
I've had a lot of requests for that. So I think in the future, I'm not going to mute all of the Yabba Dabbas. And so if
mute it when it gets out of control, and let's hope it does.
Yeah, that would be fine too. So it's not very disruptive. Okay, so here's the deal. ZFS scrub is not what it sounds like. It's a nice term, but and it wouldn't confuse you unless you were thinking of wondering of whether it does what SpinRite does. It doesn't. What the Z file system contains that other file systems lack, and which is where it gets its reputation, its deserved reputation for robustness, is it goes checksum crazy. It checksums everything. And other file systems don't do that. There are ways to rebuild them, but they don't tolerate the overhead of checksums. ZFS was designed with this from the beginning. So what a scrub is, and a scrub is not something that the file system does automatically. It's a command you can invoke. It can run in the background while the file system is live, but it's tying up a lot of resources, as we'll see in a second. So you may notice degraded file system performance during the scrub, and it can take a long time. I saw a 28-hour scrub report when I was poking around learning more about ZFS a couple weeks ago. So, I mean, it's a multi-day sort of process. Again, because, you know, file systems tend to be big now. And what the scrub does is it is a manually invoked checksum verify. So there's no reason to believe that the checksums would be wrong, but the system doesn't just go through and scrub them all, which is the term ZFS uses for going through without any reason to believe there's a problem, just to do. It's like a high-end verify pass. I want to verify that my file system is pristine, that, you know, no bit rot, as it's called, has crept in, because that can happen, as we've seen. And so this does that. This reads every block, computes the checksum of that block, and then verifies it against the stored checksum for the block, basically doing a checksum of the entire file system. So as you can see, that's not what SpinRite does. SpinRite, of course, is about, and it doesn't obviously mess with non-file system space. So it's not concerning itself with preserving or checking the integrity of any sectors not in the file system, that is, that are not in use. SpinRite is about the lower level, as Trevor says, the metal level, of going through and absolutely verifying and or repairing the data that the drives store. And to answer his final question, yes, everybody who's ever worked at GRC, as far as I know, I know I've checked in with several of them years afterwards, we all run SpinRite on any system we're setting up. I ran SpinRite on all of the drives in my new Win7 box. I run SpinRite on the drives at GRC. I know that Greg is running it all the time on any systems that he's setting up for others and for himself. So, you know, those of us at GRC are believers. I just want to just verify the drive, because without running SpinRite, you just don't know what condition the drive is in, and they're not. And sometimes you're surprised. I've returned brand new drives where I run SpinRite on them fresh out of the box, and it has pushed down the relocated sector count or the seek seek count has gone way higher than it should. Both are things that SpinRite shows you while it's running, and that just means this is a sick drive. I mean, it's sick, you know, right from the box. And so I send it back, and I get another one. I'll run SpinRite on it, and it'll behave itself perfectly. And so I'm glad I didn't use that drive that was never – there was sooner or later, and probably sooner, going to give me a problem. So, yeah, we'd absolutely use it for preventative maintenance. And, again, I plan at some point to talk about ZFS in detail because it is a fascinating, beautiful piece of work, and I'm seeing it more and more. In fact, I configured that that most recently built Unix box, not the FreeNAS server that is running ZFS, just because that's the way it came. And it was easy to set up a ZFS pool, as they're called. But the forum server is using UFS and a hardware RAID. I want the experience of using ZFS with JBOD, just a bunch of disks. And so it's the last thing I need to do before I bring that server public, because I'll have to take it down in order to convert the file system over. But I want to do that because everywhere I look, you know, ZFS is taking over.
Okay. Good, because I'm ready to run it. I'm thinking about converting my my home cloud, which is right now running Sandstorm. FreeNAS supports Docker, right? So I could run Sandstorm in a Docker on FreeNAS, and then I'd have ZFS. I'm thinking about doing that. Would be crazy to do that, but I'm thinking.
Well, you're having fun. And
that's all that counts. I crave ZFS.
So, okay. HTTP protocol flaws.
We're ready. This is now the Black Hat DEF CON segment.
Yes, we're back. We're back to Black Hat and DEF CON. We talked. I'll do HTTP first, and that because this is interesting. This is a new attack that's been called HEIST, HEIST, which is an acronym or an abbreviation for HTTP encrypted information. Can be stolen through TCP windows. There's some details of TCP protocol that I've never bothered to get into because it's really down in the weeds. I guess I did actually talk about it years back. The TCP window is something which is an evolution of TCP, which is an agreement by the endpoints about how much receive buffer each one has, which gives the sender permission to send unacknowledged data ahead. So each end is essentially as the ACK packets are being sent to the other end to acknowledge to affirmatively acknowledge how much of the TCP stream has been received so far, and it's now possible to be a lazy ACKer where you only acknowledge every while as long as you do it often enough that you're not worried about freaking out the sender and causing it to start retransmitting packets that you've already received. So you want to acknowledge frequently enough that you keep everything flowing. But the idea is that especially when we have what's called a large bandwidth delay product, that is, we're at distant points of the earth and the bandwidth is low, so that the delay is high. We want, and that what that means is the round trip time is extremely long. So TCP works by the sender sending something and the receiver acknowledging its receipt. Well, since the acknowledgement will take can take a long time to get back, we want the sender to be able to send ahead. And so what happens is the acknowledgement packet contains permission, a 16-bit permission, and in later versions of TCP, that's scalable. So you can not do it by bytes, but you can do it by larger increments because these days the bandwidth delay products are much bigger or can be. That permits the sender to essentially that so-called window, which it's called an advertisement, the window advertisement that the recipient is sending with its acknowledgement says, at this time, you are free to send this many bytes unacknowledged, meaning that the receiver can confirm its ability to provide the buffer space necessary. So the sender just can blast away without requiring incremental receipts. So it turns out that what these researchers found was, and this is what's unique about this, a browser-based way of sensing the actual size of data at the packet level, and which sounds like, okay, who cares, except that we've seen places, crime was one, Beast was one. There have been a number of attacks on HTTP where, as we'll remember, where the compression was reverse engineered. That is, it was possible by guessing a whole bunch of times to determine what some unseen compressed data was by putting your own data in, which would be combined with the compressed data. Remember that the way the compression works is that you get more compression if you have more redundancy. And so if you put in data which turns out to be redundant, the total size increases less than if you put in data that was not redundant. So that's a really roundabout, indirect way of figuring out, painfully, but, you know, hackers, they're clever and patient, figuring out what data you can't see by seeing how large the compressed result of what you can't see plus what you can see because you put it in ends up being. These guys figured out a way for JavaScript to determine the size of data being sent, which moves these previous man-in-the-middle attacks, because you had to be typically a man-in-the-middle to make this practical, that's moved those attacks into the browser. It's still, you know, fringe and not something you need to really run around worrying about, I think, but an interesting hack and no doubt a great presentation for, I don't know, I didn't note here whether it was Black Hat or, oh yes, Black Hat presentation. So that's HTTP, the heist attack. The other presentation at Black Hat last week was four new what I would call a protocol implementation flaw. Not necessarily a flaw in the protocol, but side effects of first, you know, version one implementations in HTTP/2. HTTP/2, we did a podcast on it, I don't know, about a year ago, looking at what features it offered. There's a bunch of cool things it does. For example, and these, you know, this was originally driven by Google's efforts to improve the efficiency of the whole internet. An observation, for example, was that web browsers are almost always sending non-varying headers. The same, you know, if a web page is queried, all these requests go out for all the assets that populate the HTML page, and they've all got all these query headers. This metadata that's not part of the actual data goes out. You know, things like, I have a copy that expires on this date. Do you server have something newer? I'm this user agent. I'm this language. I'm this quality of service, and so forth. A whole bunch of stuff per query, which typically does not change. So it's been observed that this is a lot of redundant junk, especially if the little objects you're getting back are small, that all of this header information can be a substantial percentage of the total payload. So reducing header redundancy, compressing headers. There's also this notion of streaming, where normally a browser is only allowed to have two connections to a remote server, to a given remote server IP, in order just to keep this under control. The problem is that a page which is loading a whole bunch of things, like maybe a page has a whole bunch of little things and a few big blobs. If the requests are made for the blobs, then all the little things have to wait in line behind the blobs, waiting for those to finally get sent by the server in order for the page to then be able to show all the little things that may actually be more interesting or more immediately useful than the big blobs. So what HTTP2 does is it multiplexes that single connection. In fact, we drop to one connection now, which is multiplexed so that multiple queries can be sent and multiple pieces of responses can be received in any order that the server wants to send them. And so that's a potentially a huge win for just the feel of web pages. Well, security researchers, being what they are, they said, I wonder what mischief we can get up to with this stuff. There is a famous old attack that we talked about a long time ago called a compression layer attack. It's also been known as a zip bomb. The idea is we've talked a lot about interpretation recently, about how, for example, the TIFF image and JPEGs and all kinds of file formats are sort of a meta description of their contents, so that the thing that is reading them is reading the file metadata, which then tells it what the following data is. Well, compression is very much like that. When you have a compressed file, you have control information mixed in with data. And the presumption is that the presumption made by the decompressor is that a friendly compressor generated the compressed data. But that's not necessarily so. And it turns out that you can horribly crash HTTP2 servers if you deliberately mess around with the header compression. It is possible for a single connection to tie up as much as a gig of server RAM, and you can do that as many times as you want to until the server crashes. So in their presentation of what they called the HPAC bomb, the attacker crafts a small and apparently innocent messages which decompress into significant amounts of data, as in gigabytes on the server, bloating the server's memory footprint and often crashing the server. And so, for example, one of the ways you might compress a block of null space, a block of all zeros, you know, say that you had 16K of zeros. Well, and in fact, .exe files, one of the things that's so annoying about the Microsoft .exe format is that it's incredibly inefficient. And there are huge regions huge tracts of land of null space in the middle of these files. So instead, an intelligent compressor recognizes, it sees all this null space and goes, oh, wait a minute. And so it puts in a special marker that says, here's a zero, duplicate that 16,000 times. Well, what if you said 16 billion times? Oops. So clearly, we need sanity checking on the decompression to make sure that this compressed meta representation of the headers is sane, that it makes sense, that it's not totally crazy. We don't have that today. So that's an example. Another is something known as the slow read attack, where a malicious client deliberately reads responses very slowly. And we did talk about this also a long time ago. It was called the slow loris attack. It was an early form of DDoS where you would establish connections with the server and you just would not acknowledge the receipt of data very quickly, which forced the server to keep the connection up. And that allowed you plenty of bandwidth and time to initiate many, 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 many more connections, all which would also be slow. And eventually they would pile up. Well, it turns out that this was done by Imperva Research, and they tested variants of this, essentially this slow read attack, on Apache, IIS, Jetty, Nginx, and NGHTTP2, all able to bring the server to a standstill at this point. Just something that the protocol doesn't yet handle, but needs to in sort of, you know, version 0.9. There's also in some details in the way the HTTP2 protocol is implemented, something known as the dependency cycle attack, which takes advantage of some flow control mechanisms, which are new in HTTP2, which support network optimization. And in this case, again, a malicious client is able to craft requests that induce sort of an interflow dependency, which puts the server into an infinite loop, essentially, as it tries to resolve these deliberately intertwined dependencies, and for which there's no resolution. It's sort of the Kobayashi Maru attack on HTTP2. And then they've also come up with a way of abusing this stream multiplexing that I had mentioned before. So these are not showstoppers. It doesn't mean that there's, you know, like we need to fix HTTP2. That's why I call these implementation errors. And we do need to fix the implementation. And I'm sure after this presentation at Black Hat, all of these server implementations are in the process of, you know, playing with these attacks themselves and coming up with mitigations for them. So they all look like things like, oh, you know, we just didn't consider that a client would be evil. So with a new protocol, you are inherently opening new opportunities for clients to misbehave. And that's why we have Black Hat and DEF CON.
Your mention of sanity check reminded me, if you don't mind, a little interruption.
Yeah.
I got an email from Patrick, our engineer over here. He runs the API and so forth. And there's somebody in Australia who loves this show because he has run a script to download every episode. A lot of people do that. But he neglected one minor detail. He forgot to put an end number in it for the last episode. So he has been downloading since July, the end of July. Just downloaded, or tried to, episode 306,003. which I'm sorry to say we won't actually be recording until the year, according to Patrick's calculations, 7889.
Yeah, your lease will have long since expired.
So just a little tip, if you're going to write a script to download, you might, A, want to keep an eye on it, and B, have an upper limit, you know. In fact, Patrick suggests using our API because there are shows with weird numbers like, you know, 85A or 103SE.
Yeah, actually, Security Now has a couple of those.
Well, that's, yes, this is guy's doing Security Now. API will deliver you not only all of the numbers, but not just a simple numeric succession, but in fact, every show episode, and you can ask the API, and then you won't be downloading episodes in the high hundred thousands.
It demonstrates a lot of hope.
A lot of hope. He doesn't want to miss any of them. You just got to keep running that till you get there. Anyway, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt, but you reminded me.
No, it's okay. I've got one last item, and I was going to follow up on it anyway next week. So I'll just tease everybody with it. I need – this is bad enough that I need to understand it more than I do. And so I'm going to have to do a bit of research. But here's the deal. Back in 1997, 19 years ago, hackers found that Windows 95 and WinNT could be induced to send the username and password out of the system.
I know where you're going with this one. I know where you're going here.
The way that was done is the web browser could be given by a malicious web page, be given a resource on what looks like a Windows file share, a so-called SMB, server message block, or, you know, also known as CIFS. But and that's the standard Windows file and printer sharing protocol. In the same way that most resources or assets that are browser queries, you know, are HTTP:// or sometimes even FTP or other things, you can do SMB. You can actually tell a Microsoft browser to get something over SMB that's not local. And so 19 years ago, this was brought to Microsoft's attention. They know about it, knew about it, and said, yeah, okay. We're not going to, you know, that's by design. We don't think it's a problem. Now, the argument at the time was that, you know, somebody in Russia gets your PC's username and password. What are they going to do? Presumably, there's no way to log in remotely into that machine. So the fact that, I should mention, they don't get the password, but, and I forgot to say, they get what is, I completely missed the whole punchline. And that is that part of this SMB protocol provides your current logged in credentials with the query. So with the query that goes out over the internet, from your Microsoft web browser. Now, that's one of the mitigators here, is that Chrome and Firefox don't do this. Only IE and Edge do. But Edge does. And that's why this suddenly got important is, as we know, Microsoft started using your Windows 10 authentication for much more than just Windows. So whereas 19 years ago, this may not have been a problem, or, I mean, still, it would never make anyone comfortable who knew about it. Suddenly, it's a huge exploit vector. Any Windows 10 user who is using Edge, who I imagine that's what most Windows 10 users are using, unless, you know, you're a higher end user, you're a listener to the podcast and you've chosen to use Chrome or Firefox. But if you're using Edge and you haven't done anything different, and you go to a web page that that wants to get up to some mischief, that server will send your browser a request for something that it apparently has, that is it, the server, remote server has, over the SMB protocol. Your browser will send your currently logged in username and a hash of your password. You heard that right. Your password hash to whomever asked for it, wherever they may be. There are currently two test sites that I'm afraid to go to. One of them is in Russia. I'm sorry, but I'm not going there. But there are two, and people who have written about this have gone there and have had their password cracked in 4 seconds. So their username and their password for their Microsoft Windows Live account cracked and known by an external party in a matter of seconds just by visiting a web page. Now, there are probably other mitigators here, and I just want to verify that. So I'll come back to this next week. For example, as I've mentioned, many people are now behind ISPs that filter ports 137 through 139 and 445. Those are the Windows file and printer sharing ports. So I'm assuming ISP blocking of Windows shares would solve this problem. And I, of course, with Shields Up back in the beginning, I used to greet people by their name. I'd say, "Hi, Leo." In fact, that's what happened the first time Kate showed you Shields Up. I don't know
if it said my name. I do, and I was shocked. I said, "Wah-ha! Wah-ha!"
So this kind of information leakage is old news, but it never went away. And I think it didn't occur to Microsoft that by reusing your single sign-on credentials for all these other services might create a new opportunity for exploitation. There are some registry, and unfortunately that's where they are, in the registry, it's NTLAN manager, NTLM keys in the registry that can be changed to turn off sending your credentials to remote sites. So the switch is there, but they're all on by default. And I loved it because I dug back in and I found the original report at insecure.org. They were calling them sploits, as they once did.
Sploits.
Sploits. And this was WinNT/Win95 automatic authentication vulnerability. And here's what I love. It says, parens, i.e. bug number 4. There was actually a single-digit bug count at one point.
Bug number four.
Leo, that's the fourth bug.
That must have been before.
It turns out it's not a bug. Microsoft says, quote, "We're aware of this information gathering technique, which was previously described in a paper in 2015. That is, it came back around again last year. And they said, Microsoft released guidance to help protect customers, and if needed, we'll take additional steps. Otherwise, basically they're saying, we don't think it's a problem. So various sites are reporting on this. Our friend Lawrence Abrams at Bleeping Computer has a very nice, extensive write-up. He's one of the people who, took a sacrificial machine and poked Russia, and they hacked his password. I mean, they decrypted his hash in 4 seconds. And so if anyone is concerned about this, but again, only IE and Edge. So, for example, as a Firefox user, I've never been in danger. As a Chrome user, but nobody would be. But as we know, there are occasions where a link will explicitly bring up an IE or an edge, or sometimes where something requires you to. Or you could even imagine somebody who is malicious putting up a web page that said, this valuable content you want can only be viewed under a Microsoft browser. You know, please come back under IE and Edge. And, you know, maybe if you wanted whatever you thought was there badly enough, you would. And then they could snag your username and your password hash. So that seems really bad. I'll have all the details next week.
Yeah, it's been getting a lot of attention.
Yeah.
I would guess that's probably the biggest story to come out of DEF CON or Black Hat.
Well, and 19 years old. And
pretty
Microsoft.
Impressive. Yeah.
We don't think that's a problem. Yeah. maybe it is.
We vote. I mean, what are they going to say? Oh, yeah, it's been there for 19 years and we didn't fix it? I think they're going to say, well, we didn't fix it because it's supposed to be there.
Yeah, I haven't.
So don't use IE or Edge. That's the key.
Correct.
It shouldn't be anyway.
Or Windows.
Or Windows, for that matter. I think Microsoft makes you use either Edge or IE for downloads. There's certain things
That's a very good point. Yeah. That's a very good point. I run across that snarky text. You must use Internet Explorer to obtain this. It's like, okay.
And I have installed, while you were talking, LastPass Authenticator, so we'll see. I'm not using it as my authenticator program, just for that one-tap authentication. I don't know how that works, though. And we'll find out. Does it work with everything or just some things? Or I don't know.
LastPass needs to understand the site. So it needs to...
Right. Know it that it's asking for a code.
Correct. It needs to see that there's a query. So,
and it would need all the authenticator codes, right? You'd have to set up all the...
No.
No, you don't. Okay.
Those are in your phone. And so that's the key.
Well, I'm saying you need to set that up in the phone, though, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
And, you know, that I've been disappointed that the various authenticators do not have a universal export format.
Well, that's why I use Authy. Authy does... but the problem is it stores it on its Authy servers, which is encrypted. And with it seems to be trust no one because I use my own encryption passphrase. But nevertheless, I don't know. Security's hard. That's why I listen to this show.
Security is hard. Ooh, that'd be a good title.
Yeah.
I think actually we've used that title several times.
You're doing it wrong is my favorite. Steve Gibson's doing it right every week right here, every Tuesday at 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. You can watch it live if you want at twit.tv, or you can download an episode after the fact. Steve's got them all at grc.com. He also has transcripts if you like to read along while you listen. Sometimes that helps with comprehension, or it's just a great way to search. He's got lots of stuff at the site while you're there, the sleep formula and all this stuff. And SpinRite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. You could keep up on Squirrel, and as we edge closer to the release day. And you can send him a little yabba-dabba-doo while you're at it. Buy a copy of SpinRite. We have audio and video at our site, twit.tv/SN. So, again, you don't have to be here live. You can always listen after the fact or watch even. And every podcast, I mean, 11 years, Steve, 11 years. That's a long time.
I thought doing the column for InfoWorld for 8 years was a long time. But, yeah, we're past it by three now.
It's remarkable. Well done. You can listen to every one of them. They're all there. Every one of them, if you really wish. 572 episodes, soon 573. We'll see you next time.
Thank you, my friend.
Security now.